This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Dara Horn about her book, Eternal Life. It's a novel, your fifth, if I recall correctly.
Yes.
How are you?
Great. Really happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for coming. It's January 2018. The book is just out.
Yes.
I know you're going to events.
Yes.
I think you're doing one tonight.
Mm-hmm.
At the Green Light.
Yeah, Green Light in Brooklyn, yes.
Yeah. So how do you feel like going out in public talking about this book now?
It's been fun. I mean, I just had one event on Monday and another tonight, so it's new. Yeah. And I'm not bored with talking about it yet, so that's good.
Well, that's true. We get you at the very beginning.
Yes.
So you can test your storytelling about
exactly.
the book with us. So one thing I'm curious about, you have a PhD in comparative literature,
mm-hmm.
but you were writing fiction really young, I assume, because your first book came out when you were 25, before you even had your PhD.
Yes.
So how do you combine those two things, you know, the kind of criticism, interest in literature with being a writer yourself?
I think it's... I don't think it's true that there's any conflict between those things, because books really come from other books, right? I mean, I know we think of, write about what you know, but of course, you know, that's what you know is quite limited, right? And you know, why ignore the whole history of humanity in favor of what
right.
you know, right? I mean, what I know is really not much compared to the history of humanity. So my academic work is very intertwined with my fiction, because my doctorate is in comparative literature, as you mentioned. My specialty within that was in Hebrew and Yiddish literature. And I actually started writing novels because of my academic work. I started writing novels because I was reading writers who were writing in those languages, and I became very jealous of them. And the reason I was jealous of them was because writers who were writing in these ancient languages, or languages that had been revived from ancient times, they had this resonance that they were able to bring into their work, where even if they were writing contemporary secular stories, they were able to sort of bring in these references and allusions to these ancient religious texts and just sort of weave them very seamlessly into the work. And it almost was natural for a lot of these writers. And, you know, I think every language has an archaeology of belief that's kind of built into it, right, that kind of rises to the surface whenever somebody sneezes. And most people don't think about it very consciously, but I do. And so in writing these novels, I've sort of tried to bring that spirit of those languages into English for English language readers to have access to. So writing really contemporary, secular is not a great word, but contemporary secular, mm-hmm. modern secular literature, but that sort of draws on that well of ancient texts.
Right. And this book actually is a really good example of that, I think.
Yes.
Because intertwined with this is so much real history of the Jews at the temple
yes.
in the time of Rome,
mm-hmm.
and which you clearly know something about because it sort of suffuses the novel. But you've brought it into the present with a character who comes from that time. And, of course, that's the conceit or the construct of the book. And I don't think we're giving too much away, because the title is Eternal Life. Your main character can't die.
Yes.
And that's sort of the challenge of the book. And I think, you know, I wanted to ask you about that. It's almost impossible not to, because it's so hard, I think, to write about the concept of eternal life it just seems hard because you have so many, we all want, you know, have that in the background, you know, the notion of what would it be like to live forever?
Yes.
And of course, here you're imagining it and you have to cope with it and make it new at the same time. Which I think you did really
yes.
well, because you made her complicated. And she still is living all of her lives in the present.
Yes.
And all of her lives in the past. And which is, you know, I think a really Jewish thing, you know,
right.
it
well,
seems.
I think, well, so here's the thing that when you talk about, you know, how to make this story unique, so to speak, right, is that... you know, you, that it's hard to, you know, how, or, well, your question was really more like about how you bring an eternal character to life, right? Because this is someone who's living a life so different from every life that right. we've ever seen.
And so many lives.
Right, and so many lives, right. So, well, and I think that the piece of that that makes this a little, and as you said, that, and in order to make this person complicated, right, you know, that... Look, I mean, this is, as you said, it is a story about a woman who can't die. This is not an original idea, right? I mean, there's stories about immortal characters.
Well, no, but what is really original is that you have her and her, let's call her her twin, her male twin, the lover that is entwined with her that can never die either. That's not... that's something I don't think I can remember reading before.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's unusual. And then also really just even just that when you think about stories of classical stories about immortal characters, they're almost never fertile women.
Yes.
Right? I mean, this is a character who has been married 45 times, has right. had hundreds and hundreds of children, and well, outlived all of those
right.
children.
And I think that the motherness there you also dealt with in a really, I thought it was powerful to imagine her, to feel her feeling the loss so personally, you know, because it is sort of abstract when we think of, well, you live forever and all the people that you know and love will die and then new ones will come along and they'll die.
Yes.
But when you're the mother, it's different.
Of
you know,
course.
It comes from your body and the feeling of loss and the feeling of, I don't know how to, I'm not sure what I mean, but, you know, it's not just the loss, but it's the memory, I think, of all of those children. That was, I think that was really powerful.
Yes. Well, and that she never forgets any child, right, right. of hundreds of children right. that she's had. But right. I think also, you know, what you're tapping into, too, is also that, you know, these stories about immortality that are, you know, let's say the Highlander or something like that, you know, there's something that puts you apart when you're, you know, these immortal characters in literature. It's like they're distinct from everyone else, whereas the whole experience of motherhood and, you know, today I would say parenthood, really, but the traditional experience of motherhood is like your life is not about you, right? Your life is supposed to be, and this is sort of the traditional concept, is, you know, devoted to people younger than you who are ostensibly going to outlive you, right? So, I mean, that's the whole idea of what is your life for becomes something more like who is your life for? Mm. And, you know, there's, you know, traditionally women's lives were so much more defined by obligation than by ambition, right? And so much of who she is, it's not that she's defined by her children, but that everything she's doing every day is about that experience of her children. And
right.
and that she, I mean, in a sense, that's actually what causes her to get into this situation to begin with. This, you know, is not too much of a spoiler, but right. How she gets into this situation to begin with is to is a bargain that she makes or a vow that she takes in the ancient temple in Jerusalem, which is the purpose of which was to save the life of her first child. So that's sort right. of how she gets herself into this situation.
Right.
But it is true that she is experiencing eternity in a very different way than her equally immortal lover. As you said, that is the other difference between this, is that we have these two people who are sort of circling each other throughout
right.
For this eternal life.
Right, which is kind of also, you know, that's the other theme of eternal love, which is really hard over centuries, you know, 2,000 years, you are repeating your story over and over again in each life, not happily every time, you know, it's sort of you're entwined, but it's not like eternal bliss.
No, it is very much not.
Right. So that makes it also, I think that also makes it interesting. And I hadn't thought of it before until you said that, but she's, you know, when you, it's like a play on the notion of the goddess, the eternal mother.
Yes.
But think about the eternal mother, what it would really be like, you know, to be always reborn into this, giving all the time. You know, it's really hard.
Yes.
It's not, I mean, it's rewarding and it's wonderful, but it's, you know, she, in the end, I don't think we're giving it away. She is, you know, in this life that you put her in, she does feel like she wants to die.
Yes.
She wants to end it.
Yes.
And there's this great scene. I think, I really think this is one of the, I read, one of the only problem I have with this book is that after you read it, you have to go back and reread the beginning, because your understanding of the story changes.
Yes.
And that, I mean, that may be true with a lot of books. But it was complicated because I wanted to re-understand, you know, how I got there. And I reread the scene where she goes to see a psychiatrist.
Yes.
And I actually, that's a laugh out loud. It was funny the first time, but it was the second time. Once you know the story, it is actually much funnier to read it again. And that was one of the, it was really, really a great scene. It's just hilarious to have her talking to the psychiatrist and telling her the truth.
Yes. Well, so, right. And this, and of course, so what happens is, as you say, like she's depressed, so to speak. And so, right. You know, she goes to see a psychiatrist because she's depressed. Of course, she already has tried, you know, the alchemists and the high priests and the, you know, right. whatever, you know, the witches and the,
over hundreds of years.
She's had, you know, she's been to see the, whoever the soothsayer is of that
right.
century.
So you're not letting go. I mean, you're not hiding that you consider the psychiatrist the equivalent.
Well, I mean, I don't know that those other people were ineffective.
Right.
Right, but I maybe they were effective too. So, but she goes to see the psychiatrist and you know says I think I'm depressed. And of course, the psychiatrist says, I got to ask you this clinical question: do you ever think about killing yourself? And she, of course, says all the time, but it won't work. It's just a fantasy.
That's right. I can't.
Exactly.
You know, it won't work.
And of course, the psychiatrist is relieved. Right.
Right, but then she considers her to be bipolar.
Yes,
you know?
Of course. Well, when she tells, because she tells exactly the truth of her
right.
life to this.
She has no framework for understanding.
Of course not.
Which makes sense, of course. And you mentioned that your character, both of them have actually told people, I live forever. And people is like, yeah, right.
Exactly. Like, it's not a problem telling right. people because they never
believe you.
Exactly.
But there is also that other theme that is kind of dark. There's a little darkness there about, which I wasn't quite sure I fully understood, but that when a certain child or grandchild might figure it out, that put them at risk.
Yes.
And is that because of the vow, essentially, because the bargain with God was so, I mean, it's strict, you know, you can't break the bargain with God.
Yes.
Is that what that was about?
Well, exactly. Well, first that you can't break the bargain with God. And in fact, there's sort of just a logistical problem with this, because they made this vow in this ancient temple in Jerusalem, which, historical fact, was destroyed by the Romans in the year 70 of the Common Era. So she can't go back to this temple and find some way out of this vow. Like this,
right.
this is like a whole religious cult that a version of ancient Judaism that no longer exists. So, you know, for physical reasons even. So there's that. But I think what you're referring to is there's this. So they can tell people that they're immortal, and of course the people nobody believes them. So that's ineffective. There are the question comes when they have this ability to prove that they're immortal, like
right.
physically prove that they're immortal. And what they have found, and they sort of very slowly discover this over the course of centuries, is that people who see evidence of their immortality do not survive that experience.
Right.
And so that's something that is not sort of stated. It's not like, here's your vow, and it comes out that way. It's
right.
something that they sort of piece together from their
right.
own experiences over the centuries of, oh, here's what happened with this one son who saw me burned at the stake during the Inquisition, and
right.
here's
and then,
this.
Yeah, yes,
so there are sort of situations that they find themselves in where what they've discovered is that basically they realize that no one can find out about this, and they don't really know why, but Eleazar, the man who the immortal character, speculates that it's because if people knew this, everyone would want it.
Right, which in fact, you have her granddaughter in this contemporaneous time wanting, you know, she's a scientist, a clinical researcher, and
exactly.
she's working on genetic issues, and she wants, she's really, her goal is to find, eternal life,
yes.
essentially, which is something that is actually, you know, that real research is going on, the life extension projects and all these
yes.
Ideas, which I think are nuts, that people should live longer, you know, than the, well, I think really 117 is the limit that we know of.
Right. Well, I mean, yes. And then there's actually I have a piece in the New York Times this week about this, an op-ed about these Silicon Valley billionaires who are hoping to live forever. And, you know, there, it is. I mean, this is one of the things that inspired me to write this book to begin with, because that started coming out about 3 or 4 years ago, that, you know, Google opened this lab that was a longevity research. And there are a bunch of venture capitalists who are invested in this. Peter Thiel is invested in this. Jeff Bezos from Amazon is doing something. It's kind of astounding how many people want to live forever. And I don't know how carefully they've thought about this.
Well, no, clearly, I think you have thought about it, and I think that they should read your book, because it's I don't have a moral or an ethical opposition to it. I don't think there's, you know, it's not like God said you should only live to be X number of years, or the, you know, somehow it's, I don't know. I don't feel like there's a kind of theoretical reason not to do it. But I think there is a practical reason, which is what you've... Well, there is another. The ethical part of it is, there, with millions of people starving to death, the notion that you would put resources toward having some small number of people live forever in a world which has limited resources to begin with makes no sense. Yeah. It's like there's no logic to that.
Yes. Well, look, I mean, I think that the thing about longevity research, and I did say this in the Times piece, is, you know, if it turns out that, you know, to get self-absorbed people to invest in unsexy subjects like Alzheimer's research, you need to convince them that, oh, this is about immortality. Well, okay, then, you know, if we all benefit from some inanity of people being wanting to live forever and we end up with a cure for dementia or something, that's not going to complain about that. And I think, you know, a lot of the longevity research is more about, you know, healthier lives, and that's, you know, I can't argue with that. But I think what I'm really, the practical issue, I think, is, you know, you talked about population. It's also just about what gives life meaning, right? Which is this, you know, a lot of, you know, there's, you know, and everyone's going to find their own meaning in life. But if you think about what's most meaningful to you in your life, it's relationships with other people, right? And the dynamism of those relationships, right? And, you know, watching your child grow up, let's say, or, you know, in your creative works, you know, seeing how far you can push the limits of your creative work, or, you know, if you're doing scientific research, seeing, you know, how much you can discover about the way the world works. You know, these are really dynamic things. And that dynamism kind of relies on there being a kind of an arc to our lives, right? Because if you're thinking about what are you creating for the future? It's like, well, what future are you talking about, right? You know, it's like we're improving the world. There's a one point where Eleazar, my male lead in this male female immortal pair, in contemporaneous times, as you put it, he becomes an internet troll among many other professions he has. He's sort of is trolling people online, and he's trolling these, longevity researchers online. And one of the things he says is, you know, they're posting these things about improving the world. And he says, improve the world for who? Our infinite children? He's like, here's your big picture. They do not want us around for eternal life.
Right. But and that's sort of a kind of, I mean, that's the sort of humorous way of saying, but the serious part of your, of what you expose with her not being able to die is that the arc of life is what makes it meaningful.
Yes.
And so she has this challenge to, I mean, of course she does get to make it meaningful over and over again, but I think she feels like she's missed out on the opportunity to have an endpoint so that the meaningfulness of the period of time she's on Earth is preserved.
Yes. I mean, there's one point where she says she wanted to be judged.
Yeah. But you you have this sort of thing that she repeats also, that you don't know yourself until the day you die.
Yeah, don't believe in yourself.
Don't believe in yourself until the day you die.
Actually, it's a line from the Talmud.
She cannot do.
Yeah.
And so there's that she'll never be fulfilled. And that's really what that's about. The fulfillment comes from living the whole life. Because that's what, life is.
And also about relationships. And because relationship, any kind of intimate relationship, whether it's with a partner or a child or a parent or anyone really, requires vulnerability. Right? I mean, and if you're immortal, you're not vulnerable, right? And so that's right. And that's something that you know, you see also that's, you know, you mentioned this relationship that these two people have. You know, it's like, well, are they lovers? Are they former lovers? It's, you know, if they were checking a box on Facebook, it would be like, it's complicated, right? Because it's complicated, right? I mean, there are people who have read this book and said it's, you know, an amazing story of true, eternal true love. And there are people who have read this book say there's sort of an epic tale of stalking. And, you know, I mean, it gets sort of depends on your point of view.
Right. Well, they are, I think, for me anyway, codependent.
Well, that's true.
They are, it may be true love, it may be something weird, but they can't live without each other. Each other either. Right. So,
well, they can always live without each other, right? They live forever and ever, right?
But,
you know,
but it's they sort keep of, coming back. So
yes.
That, and that may be a part of the vow that they also are not fully cognizant of, you know, and are learning, or maybe they realize, is that they made the vow together.
Yes.
So they're going, and besides which, they're the only two people who have done that.
And who understand each other
right.
in that way.
So they
right?
have no choice. And she keeps trying to get him, you know, she keeps trying to go away from him.
Yes.
And not found, and he finds her. And, you know, they
it's
repeat
a matter of time
this pattern.
Until he finds her.
Right. It's sort of like, you know, in psychological terms, you know, we're always, you know, you're always repeating the same mistake or repeating the
yes.
same pattern in your relationships, you know. Well, they are really, you know,
yes.
they're kind of, they're epically and mythologically repeating. And maybe in that way they can be mythological, but they have to go, they would have to end up in the sky.
Yes.
You know?
Well, that's, you know, I mean, it's sort of like, you know, the epic version of, you know, your bad high school girlfriend or boyfriend who never leaves you alone and
right.
always is like always trying to get back together. Right.
Right.
I mean, and it's like, imagine if they really never went away.
I know.
And, you know, it's like they're stalking you through the centuries. And, you know, part of that is also, though, you know, when you say that they are codependent or they keep this dysfunctional relationship that keeps going, you know, some readers have said, like, you know, like, well, you know, aren't they going to learn from this? It's like, well, no.
No.
They can't learn because they can't change.
Right.
Right? That's the curse, right? Or is it a blessing or is it a curse, this immortal existence?
Right.
But the problem with their relationship is that neither of them can change.
Well, and if you converted it to Greek terms, this is sort of the height of hubris.
Yes.
To live forever.
Of course.
As if you were a god. And look what happens. You know, this is the curse of, they got what she wanted. The reason that they did it in the first place,
save this child.
Yeah, to save the one child.
Yes.
But as the rabbi, the high priest said at that time, you're trading your death for that child's
yes.
life. And those bargains are always fraught.
Of course.
You know, in sort of classic, you know, God is not an easygoing being to deal with.
Yes.
And humans don't have a clue. So that's sort of what you're about here,
yes.
I think.
Well, and I mean, this relationship, you know, in traditional Judaism, one way that is the relationship between God and the people of Israel is sometimes characterized as a romance. And you know, I've often thought of that. It's like, well, if it's a romance, it's a kind of a sadomasochistic romance.
I would say,
or at least a little bit
yeah.
of, you know, it's a very, as we say, complicated
yeah.
romance. And so that was something else I sort of was thinking about as I created these characters. You know, there's a, you know, that you're moving away and also always coming back.
Right. I hadn't even thought of that. It just came to my mind that as you were talking about that, that these two could be seen as the chosen people. In their own way, you
in
know,
some
the
sense.
Chosen of the chosen.
Yes. Well, I mean, because that's something that, you know, that this is obviously sort of a, you know, for lack of a better word, a fantastic or science fiction premise that this woman lives forever, right? But there is something where it is a little bit of a metaphor for Jewish history, right? Because
right.
this is a people that has lived far beyond any historical precedent would suggest that it would, and, you know, that at there is something, you know, you don't have to believe in anything supernatural to see that there's something surreal about the survival of the Jewish people over thousands of years. I mean, despite many attempts to annihilate them. So that's, I did think about that as well as I was creating this, the 2,000-year-old,
oh, yeah.
these 2,000-year-old characters.
Right. That's real. No, I like that. So do you mind reading just a little
bit? Oh, of course.
I think the writing in this book is really wonderful. One of the things I think is when you read a book and you don't notice the construction and you don't notice the language, that's sort of beautiful design. And I thought it was really, really well written.
Okay, so I'm just going to read just about a page.
Okay.
So this is a... very, very close to the beginning. And my main character, Rachel, is at, she runs a family business and she's at a meeting. And her children and grandchildren who were at the meeting are talking about how she hasn't signed her will. And, there's this one granddaughter who's just, playing with her phone under the table. And, she's points out to her uncle, haven't you noticed? Graham is the exception to that rule that no one lives forever. She might as well sell her plot. It's not like she's going to use it. And Rachel turned to her granddaughter and grinned. Exactly, she announced. I'm the head of this company, and I've made an executive decision not to die. And then she walked out of the room. What haunted her most about the children was how many times they died. Every day of raising a child brought a rush of unwanted mourning. New parents think of each day as a cascade of beginnings. The first time she smiled, the first time she rolled over, her first steps, her first words, her first day of school. But old parents, like her, saw only endings. The last time she crawled, the last time she spoke in a pure, raw sound, unsculpted into the words of others, the last time she stood before the world in braids and laughed when she shouldn't have, not knowing. Each child died before the person did. A small rehearsal for the future. She raised her children, all of them. She raised them, nurtured them, watched them love or hate or succeed or fail, gave each of them her private excesses of possibilities, observed, sometimes from afar, what they did with them, watched her own ideas wither or grow. Then she finally watched her children die, and she was jealous. She would tell that granddaughter, she decided, as she left the building. Yet it was this granddaughter, of all her articulate descendants, who announced online to the universe, my grandmother just told us she can't sign off on her will because she can't die. Hashtag crazy old lady. Oh, child, she thought, you have no idea just how crazy I am.
I think that part is really good, too, because it shows how you combine the present with the living past in her. She's very comfortable with whatever era she's in. She has to adapt.
Yes.
And that child is really important, this Hannah.
Yes.
That becomes important in the end of the story, which we're not going to talk about.
No. but
it's really, I think it's a great... I love this book. It was really,
thank you.
It was really fun to read and think about. It's really, you want to think about what you're reading and not just be entertained. So I appreciate that. One thing I wanted to ask you, when you had mentioned Yiddish writers,
yes.
I'm just curious, like which Yiddish writers you like the best? Which ones are you read more often than others?
Of Yiddish writers?
Yeah.
I guess I have a little bit of eclectic taste. There's so many different things I love about them. One easy answer, Shalom Aleichem, who people know because the Tevye stories were adapted to Fiddler on the Roof. Tevye stories in the written version are really different. For example, Tevye doesn't live in a shtetl.
Right.
There's all kinds of other problems. But those are just magnificent books because they're just, the way he layers the language with, again, those ancient sources that he just turns totally on their head and makes so ironic and so funny. I love his work. Another writer I love is an American Yiddish writer, Yaakov Glotstein, who mostly was a poet but also wrote these – he wrote a few novels about he lived in New York and then he went back to Poland in 1934 to when his mother was dying. And he has this trilogy of novels – actually only two of them were ever published – but about this journey back to Poland. And it's really a farewell to – Eastern European Jewish life, because it was so obvious, even that. And we're talking about before World War II.
Right. But you could tell.
That this is ending. Yeah. I mean, that's what, and it's astonishing because, you read, I think that a lot of what we talk about, when we talk about the destruction of Eastern European Jewry, it's often, it becomes this kind of, it fits into, in America, we try to fit it, wedge it into like this kind of, what I would call Christian narrative, where there's some redemptive ending. you know, somebody's rescued, there's a survivors. It's like, you know, survivors are statistically insignificant when you're talking about the Holocaust. So what he does is he just treats it, all his characters are adults and are really confronting this doom as adults. And it's just and it's all walks of life. And you see just the diversity of secular and religious and different political parties and different, you know, levels of education and wealthy and poor. And he just has this whole panorama of Jewish life, and it's just beautiful, magnificent. Another writer I love is a Soviet Yiddish writer named Der Nister. I actually made him a character in one of my novels. In my novel, The World to Come, he's a character. And he just wrote these fantastical stories that are, you know, it's like really like dreams, almost like dreams, but then you can sort of pick apart the symbolisms and see the story underneath the story. And so, oh, I could go on all day.
Well, we could do
I've taught these classes. No, I teach classes in this literature. Yeah. So.
Well, it's another, we can have another conversation about that. I think that'd be good. I'm interested in that. I was going to ask you another question. It's sort of disappeared from my head, but, I know. Have you ever thought about translating Yiddish, translating Yiddish novels into English?
I've thought about it. I think there are people who can do it better than I can. I'm a little too rooted in English. I can read, I read Yiddish. I've read things that have not been translated, but, I think it's a very particular skill, and it's a. There are definitely people who I think could do it better than I could.
No, that's right. I wasn't trying to put you on the spot.
No,
I was just curious.
Fine.
So, well, thank you so much for talking to me about this book. It was a great book, and I really enjoyed talking to you about it.
Likewise, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Dara Horn about Eternal Life, a novel, and I hope it has a long life itself.
Thank you.